Hello and welcome. I'm Tom Heck, president and founder of the International Association of Teamwork Facilitators. Today is Wednesday, July 22nd, 2015, and you have dialed in or logged in to the monthly IATF visiting faculty member call. Our guest today is Mike Robbins. I'm going to be introducing him more officially here in just a second. Today's event does include the opportunity to view a web interface where you can use a chat feature. We're already using that right now. This will allow you to ask questions of our guest and interact with the audience. And I'm going to be forwarding or kind of scrolling through and keeping track of this as we go along. You'll be able to see that chat window at www.uberconference.com/TomHeck. And on the right-hand side of the screen, you'll see a little icon that you'll need to click on to begin to view that chat window. So a little bit about the IATF. All of our work here is designed to do one thing, and that is grow inspired teams. And I think when you hear Mike's message today, you will understand why I'm so excited about the work that he's doing in the world. We support the growth of inspired teams by doing calls like this one, group and one-on-one coaching. We have an online community of facilitators, coaches, trainers, educators from 35 countries, on-site team building workshops, and more. So we have a lot going on here. And today, though, we're talking with Mike Robbins. And Mike, this is actually the second time I've interviewed Mike. He is the author of 3 books, including Focus on the Good Stuff, Be Yourself, Everyone Else is Already Taken, as well as Nothing Changes Until You Do, which is the topic that we're going to be talking about today. And if you head over to Amazon, you'll see that it has 127 reviews and a 4.5 out of 5 rating. Mike, that is awesome. We might touch on the fact today that Mike has got an interesting history in baseball. He actually played in the majors and played in college and actually pitched in the college World Series in a D1 school. And I should mention this, that much of his work focuses on working with organizations that many of us know well, like Google, Wells Fargo, eBay, The Gap, Twitter, and the list goes on and on. And his work has appeared in Forbes magazine, The Wall Street Journal. He has appeared on the Oprah Radio Network, and he is a regular contributor to The Huffington Post, which is a blog that I read several times a day. So, Mike, welcome to the call.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me back. Good to be here with you and your great community. I appreciate it.
Yeah, well, I'm excited to have you here. So I have been poring over videos, interviews, the work that you have written in preparation for today's call. And I have to say, and here's me being vulnerable, this is a harder topic, I think, for me to interview you on. And so I'm really hopeful that our listening audience is going to have some questions for you. But I want to start with this.
Yeah.
Help this group of people who work with teams, who work with leaders.
Yeah.
Why do they need to read a book and understand the message that you're sharing here in Nothing Changes Until You Do? So in other words, frame this from the standpoint of team and leadership development.
Yeah. Well, there's a couple of things. I mean, first of all, you know, as you mentioned when you introduced me, you know, Tom, I mean, I've been working for the last 15 years. And the primary focus of my work, I mean, I do a lot of speaking at conferences, keynote type stuff. But I also do a lot of work inside of organizations with leadership teams, executive teams, and you know, teams of all different types, and have done that type of work for the last 15 years prior to, you know, you talked a little bit about my sports career. I mean, I was on lots and lots of teams, right, as a baseball player for a long time. And so, you know, I wrote this book for a couple of reasons. First and foremost, I mean, it's very personal. You know, you've read it. a lot of personal stories from my own life, some of my own struggles, some of my own insights, some of a lot of what I've learned from my clients over the years. And a number of the stories and examples in the book actually come from some of the teams and leaders that I've worked with. But specifically, you know, the core focus of this book is really about a couple things. It's about self-compassion and how we can transform in a positive way our relationship with ourselves. And it's also about personal responsibility and ownership. And I believe, look, so how this frames up in terms of teamwork and leadership, look, all of us who are listening to this call and engaged in this conversation, when we go in to work with teams of people, one of the things I think we're trying to do as best we can is support them in enhancing their emotional intelligence, right? There's lots of different things we may be doing, and based on our expertise, I mean, that's a lot of what my work focuses on. But what's emotional intelligence, right? It's self-awareness and self-management, social awareness, and relationship management, right? And the hardest part of emotional intelligence is the self part, I think. I mean, as tricky as people are in relationships and team dynamics and all that stuff, it's like, how do we deal with ourselves most effectively? And I see this a lot, as I'm sure many people listening, and Tom, you can probably relate to this. You go into work with a team and you realize that one of the biggest issues is a lack of self-awareness that the leader in charge may have, right? Mm-hmm. He or she doesn't even realize some of the things they're doing or saying that's, you know, getting in the way of things working, if you will. So again, anything that we can do to open up a dialogue around how we think about, relate to, and are aware of ourselves, or maybe sometimes even not aware, I think is fundamental. Because teams are essentially made up of individuals, right? So at some level, we've got to be able to address the individual while at the same time focusing on what's best for the team.
So that's great. A great way to start the framing of this. In chapter 3 of the book, you mention a counselor by the name of Eleanor.
Yes.
Who you worked with. And there's that chapter 3, actually, you mentioned that a conversation that you were having with her resulted in the title of this book. I'm wondering if you can share with us how that came about.
Yeah, so Eleanor's great, by the way. I've been working with her for the last 3-4 years. I write about her a lot in the book. I actually just had a session with her this morning. So, I mean, we would do our sessions on the phone. I mean, think of her like I call her a counselor because she's more than just a coach for me. She kind of, you know, we talk about all kinds of things personally, professionally. But she basically said to me, look, Mike, you keep trying to change the circumstances and the situations and relationships in your life, and you keep thinking that if those things change, then, you know, you get what you want kind of thing, right? She said, you got to remember, it doesn't work that way. It's the other way around. I said, what do you mean? She said, nothing changes until you do. And it was, you know, this was a couple years back when we had that particular conversation. And it wasn't like, Tom, I'd never heard that concept or even that phrase, but there was something about her saying it right at the time. And when she did, I went, oh my gosh, wow, she's right. Like the changes that I want to make in my life and my business and, you know, it really is like I'm the common denominator in everything that's going on. And another way this relates back, I believe, to the work that we all do as, you know, coaches and consultants and trainers and teamwork facilitators and all the different people who are listening to us and connected to IATF is, look, when we show up in the room with a team, if we're going to be able to have our attention on them and really coach them and help them, we got to walk into that room, not perfect, not like we have everything in our life handled, but some level of present and engaged and connected with ourselves so that we can show up for them, right? And every single person who's listening to us right now, Tom, I'm sure you can relate to this as well. When we go in there and our attention is on ourselves, or we're worried about, am I doing a good job, or what do they think, or how's this going to go, or I'm not sure, or can I really take that risk, or can we really do this exercise, or whatever, we're not as effective. Mm-hmm. Right? We got our head up our own you-know-what, and we're so concerned about doing a good job that we actually don't. When we can put our attention on them, fully put our attention on them, and in order to do that, we got to kind of sort some of our own stuff out, if you will. That's why, like, the work I do with Eleanor, the work that my own inner personal work is fundamental to the work that I do professionally. Because the more I change, the more I grow, the more I evolve, the more I open up, the more empathy, compassion, awareness, the more I expand my own emotional intelligence, if you will, the better equipped I am to support other people in doing it. The less I do that myself, like, and we all know this, you get burned out, you get stressed out, we're traveling around, we're doing lots of stuff, we're not balancing or managing our life very well, it impacts our work, right? It impacts our ability. Now, the people in the room may not, you don't have to walk in and go, you know, I got in a fight with my wife and my life's kind of out of balance and I haven't exercised in a while and I'm feeling kind of crappy. No, but that's all going to come through in the work that we do.
Yes.
You know, and I think of this a lot. I say to my wife, Michelle, a lot. It's like, you know, my training is as an athlete. And I knew there were certain things I needed to do physically, mentally, emotionally to be able to go out and compete when I was playing baseball. And if I didn't do those things, my capacity was diminished in terms of my ability to be effective on the baseball field. Now, look, the stuff that I do now is much different. And in a lot of cases, more challenging in certain ways, less challenging in other ways. But when I show up in those rooms and I'm there to work with a group of people, whether it's give a speech or facilitate a session or deliver a seminar or coach someone or a group of people, like, I got to do my own work so that when I show up, I'm ready to play.
Now, Mike, I can see where someone listening to this would say, well, that makes sense for a keynote speaker, or certainly someone who, like Eleanor, who's counseling people. But now bring it into terms when you share this concept, this idea,
yep.
In my mind, a truth, but for some, maybe not a truth, in the world of Google.
Yep.
What makes them say, yes, we want our people to get this? In other words, we have a bottom line.
Yes.
You know, some change, you bring money into the equation.
Yep.
And we say, we want these numbers to read this way at the end of the quarter, so we're going to bring Mike in.
Yeah.
What is their thinking?
It's a great question. I mean, it's funny. You know, all these years of doing it, it's funny because, look, I didn't start out, Tom, with an intention of I'm going to go and work inside of organizations and help companies be more effective and successful. Quite frankly, you know, I mean, I got done as an athlete. I got hurt. I went into the business world. I mean, this was back in the 90s, and I was working. I worked in the dot-com world for a couple of years, and I noticed a couple things. So I'm going to answer your question, but I'll do it in a little bit of a roundabout way. When I was as an athlete, one of the things I noticed from a team dynamic perspective, and again, everybody who's listening to us can relate to this because we all focus on teams. I was on some teams as a baseball player where we had really, really strong talent, and we were not very good teams.
Mm-hmm.
And in baseball, something like that doesn't make sense because it's like it's all about talent, it's all about execution. It's like you get the best players together. You should be able to win more games than if you're, right? You have better athletes, you should beat the team with not as good of athletes. But there was this thing called chemistry, right? And then there were some teams I was on where the talent wasn't quite as strong, but the chemistry was really good, and we would be better teams. And I had thought erroneously that that was something related to sports. But then I got into business, and I went, oh, no, that's a human thing. Right? We call it culture. It's the same thing. Do people trust each other? Do they get along? Do they help each other be more successful? Right? And look, and you know, I started to research it and read lots of books and study this, and I realized lots of people who you know and I now know who are experts in this who'd really studied it, like, yeah, there's science behind this. There's stuff that actually we can look at and things we can focus on that can help create a healthy, positive team culture, which is going to allow people to be more successful. So that being said, I started to kind of talk a little bit about this, but my orientation to it, again, was somewhat personal, if you will. Now, but I started to talk about some of these things that I had learned as an athlete and in life and in general. And what I found was that a lot of these companies, I would come in and they would resonate with it. And then I started to realize, like, okay, even the more personal stuff, how we deal with ourselves, how we deal with each other, relates very much to the professional stuff because some of the biggest issues that organizations are facing are people issues. So why Google brings me in or why, you know, the Gap or Microsoft or New York Life Insurance, I mean, the motivation for why they might bring me in might be specific to them. There's a particular issue, but it's always coming down to a people-related challenge, meaning we're going through a big change, right?
Mm-hmm.
We've reorganized. We've merged with another company. A few years ago, we've downsized. Things have changed. People are freaking out, right? Or we're dealing with you know, our results aren't where we want them to be. And at some level, look, there's enough awareness in the business world, especially these days, and I've seen it evolve a lot in the last 15 years. They realize that people issues, relationships, teamwork, leadership, as well as now there's a big movement around wellness and well-being and wanting people to take care of themselves, that a lot of these things, like we're working way more than 9 to 5, for better or worse. People's lives need to be integrated. You know, I talked about this in my most recent TEDx talk, which is called Bring Your Whole Self to Work. One of my best clients and the client I love is The Gap. And The Gap's tagline for their wellness program for the last few years has been Better You, Better Gap. And they based it on research that said, look, if we want our people to perform at a peak level, we got to support them in taking care of themselves holistically, looking at their whole life, not just what they do when they show up at work, but like not only their health and well-being, like fitness, but how are their relationships? How are things going at home? Do they have enough time to be with their families? All these things that, again, 10, 20, 30 years ago were thought, like, that's personal stuff. We don't deal with that in the office or at work, but the most successful companies nowadays know we got to focus on this stuff. Otherwise, we're going to lose people and or they're going to burn out.
So just for clarity, what you're saying is if I want, let's say I'm leading a team.
Yep.
I'm working in Google and yep. I'm a manager. What you would say to me is, Tom, if I want a healthier team culture, in other words, I'm more nimble, we're coming up with better ideas.
Yep.
That the way I get there is that I need to work on myself.
One of the primary ways, absolutely. I mean, with leaders, you know, and Google's a great example. Now, one of the things that Google's done, and they're a fantastic company, obviously, they've been as successful as just about anybody over the last decade or so, but Google's made a significant investment and commitment to the development of their employees for a few reasons. They actually have inside of Google, and this is how, when I first got into Google about 5 years ago to do some work, they have a subsection, if you will, within their learning and development team and program called the School of Personal Growth. And many people have probably heard about my friend Meng Tan, who's a engineer at Google, wrote a book called Search Inside Yourself. He was an engineer and then sort of decided to move into the human resource world, which is an interesting move to make, especially in Silicon Valley. But Meng had been meditating for 20 some odd years, was really interested in emotional intelligence as well as mindfulness, created a program along with Daniel Goleman a number of years back called Yes. Search Inside Yourself that was really about teaching people how to meditate and how to go deeper within themselves. And it became incredibly popular at Google. It still is. He's then written a book and actually started a nonprofit organization where they're teaching this Search Inside Yourself philosophy all over the country and around the world to different organizations. But the commitment was made on the part of Google, like, look, if we're going to have some of the best and brightest people in the world come and work for us, and we want them to do some of the most cutting-edge, incredible thinking and come up with new innovative ideas, we've got to create an environment where they can take care of themselves and work on themselves, because if they don't, again, we're going to either lose them, they're going to go to another company in Silicon Valley and then compete against us, or they're going to burn out. So, again, and it's not – these ideas have now become much more mainstreamed in lots of organizations, not just in California-based Silicon Valley companies, and I happen to live out here, but all across the country and even around the world. As I travel different places, this idea and this notion of people doing their own inner work in order to be able to most effectively lead their teams and be successful at work, at least in my world – it's not that out there or radical anymore.
So I want to make this call also practical.
Yes.
If I can say that. So what would you, if I'm a manager at Google, where do I start? And again, this question could be, I'm a teacher at a middle school.
Yep.
And I want my students to have a better learning experience. I'm a parent, and I want to be a better. I want to lead my family, so to speak. Or, you know, there's using it in the broadest terms. But
sure.
Where do we start?
Well, I mean, again, I think it's like it's what Gandhi taught us, right? Be the change. What do we want to change? What do we want to influence? How do we want? I'm a middle school teacher. I'm a manager. I want to be able to, influence the people around me most effectively. I want to be able to manage the multiple, demands and challenges in my life. It's again finding the places, where do I need support? I mean, often what I'm doing, again, when I go into work with a team, we're working on multiple levels. We're looking at the individual and we're looking at the team. And then ultimately we're looking at the organization. But all three of those levels are important. And oftentimes what we'll do is, there's an exercise. And you and I talked about this the last time you interviewed me because we were talking about my book on authenticity, I believe, Be Yourself, yep. Everyone Else Has Already Taken. There's an exercise that I do when I do team sessions. And I love this exercise because it forces people in a way, and I'm not trying to do it in a way to purposefully make them uncomfortable, although it is a little uncomfortable. I talk a lot about the importance of vulnerability, which I talk a lot about, nothing changes until you do, right? Mm-hmm. And the metaphor I use is the iceberg metaphor, right? So how do you lower your waterline on your iceberg to share and express and expose a little more of who you are? And the way that this exercise works in a team environment when I work with a group is I'll always go first, by the way. And what we do is we go around, imagine sitting in a conference room, right? And I go around the table and I'll start and I'll say, what we're going to do is, I've already sort of set the context around the importance of authenticity and how authenticity is essential for trust, but that authenticity is really about being honest, but it's removing self-righteousness from honesty and adding vulnerability. And the vulnerability part is often scary. We don't want to be vulnerable. We don't want to make ourselves, look and seem weak, which is what we think often vulnerability does, which it doesn't, by the way, but that's often our initial fear is that it will. But I'll say, okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to go around the table here and I'll start and we're just going to repeat this phrase. When it's your turn, you have about 2 minutes to just repeat this phrase. If you really knew me, you'd know this about me, right? I say, look, you don't have to say anything you don't want to say, but just if we really knew you in this moment, how are you feeling? What are you thinking? What are you not saying? What's below your waterline? What's going on in your world if we really knew you right now? And I'll start. And sometimes it's responding to maybe something in the moment, how I'm feeling right then and there about being with them. And sometimes, again, I mean, I might be sitting with a CEO and his or her direct team of a big organization, and usually what I start with is, if you really knew me, I'm not sure this is a good idea. This is a little scary to have this conversation with you guys. I'm not sure, how this is going to go or if you were planning on, or whatever. Because usually that's how I'm feeling right in that moment, right? But then I'll share some things about what's happening in my life and, just, again, down below the waterline. Mm. And we go around, the next person goes and the next person goes. And what's amazing is people share all kinds of stuff. Usually it's some version of, I'm feeling scared about this. I'm feeling stressed about that. I'm really, it's just, but it's not whining and complaining. It's real stuff, right? Sometimes it's related to work and what's going on. Sometimes it's related to what's going on at home. But what's really amazing is it's just, people just open up. And I remember about a year ago, I was in New York doing this exercise with a group, and we were sitting around the table, and this one woman shared that one of her parents had died when she was a teenager. And it sounded like she hadn't told the team that. And so she was revealing this pretty significant thing that happened in her life, and she said, so if you really knew me, you would know sometimes I don't have a lot of patience for the drama that goes on around here, because when something like that happens to you, like it did to me at such a young age, it kind of puts everything in perspective. And so it sometimes may seem like I'm not that compassionate about things, when in reality, I just think a lot of the stuff that we get stressed out about is kind of stupid, right? And it was like really wise and very honest. And what it ended up doing as we went around the whole table, it kind of came back to, we had a whole deeper conversation in the group about perspective and about what things really matter and what things really don't. And it was sparked by her sharing that piece of personal information and her perspective on things. And again, I never know exactly what the heck people are going to say. But that's part of why, for me, if I show up that's why I got to do my work, so that I can show up and be able to facilitate that conversation as effectively as possible. And how and why that's relevant and important is because when teams of people have the ability to lower their water lines, so to speak, they connect with each other on a human level.
Mm.
And when we right, when, and look and think about all the work that we all do as teamwork experts and facilitators and coaches, what are we trying to get them to do? We want them to work better. We want them to work together and, you know, be more synergized in how they approach things and all that. Well, they may all end up being best friends. They might have different values. But if they can connect with each other as human beings first, as corny as that sounds, that's like one of the most fundamental things that often doesn't happen, particularly when teams get dysfunctional, is they're now thinking of each other as us and them and you and me and you're this role and I'm that role and I'm trying to edge you out. But if I can see you as a human being, living, breathing, feeling, thinking, passionate, excited, vulnerable human being, I'm going to relate to you really differently.
Okay, so Mike, maybe a year and a half ago, maybe 2 years ago, led a series of teleclasses on interviewing different people. But the theme of all of them that carried us through was the spiritual nature of team building.
Yeah.
And when I looked at your work, and I noticed, for example, that your latest book here, Nothing Changes Until You Do, was published by Hay House.
Yep.
And the previous two were by Josie Bass.
Yes.
And but Hay House struck a chord with me just because I know what kind of books are
yep.
done by Louise Hayes.
Hey, sure.
And also one of the first reviews of this book, Nothing Changes Until You Do, is by one of my favorite teachers, Michael Bernard Beckwith.
Yes.
So I'm wondering if you could share with us, because I'm choosing to believe that I attract people to this community that
yes.
are interested in looking at this work, at team and leadership development, through a spiritual lens, not a religious lens,
yep.
but through a spiritual lens. And I'm wondering if you can touch on that. I mean, we've been sort of dancing around that, but
yep.
I'm wondering if you can share your views about this type of work and how does it plug into your spiritual views?
Yeah, well, I appreciate you asking. You know, look, I mean, I do view the work that I do fundamentally as spiritual work. You know, it's funny, I don't often say it that way, and it's not that I'm afraid to. It's just, as you know, that concept or even that word can trigger people, right? Oh, and now
oh, yeah.
it turns into, are we talking about Christianity? Are we talking about Judaism? Are we talking about Buddha? What are we talking about? You know, it starts to get into this. The conversation around spirituality often can get a bit divisive and self-righteous.
Yes.
So I choose to not talk about it in those terms directly. I'm happy to. But what I find, though, is I absolutely look at my work as a huge part of my own spiritual path and my own journey. That even goes back to why the inner work piece is so important, because, again, we got to be working on ourselves if we're going to be authentically able to coach and counsel and support other people, if you will. I think there's also a nature, if you will, of looking at teamwork and the dynamic within teams and even what happens inside of organizations as fundamentally spiritual. Again, some people inside of organizations and some of the teams I work with would probably absolutely nod their head and say, yeah, for sure. Others may not necessarily or wouldn't think of it in that context. So what I've chosen to do over the years is to try to take what I believe, and this is a lot of what I think is in all of my books, particularly this most recent one, take what I believe are certain sort of universal spiritual truths and then communicate them in a way that's accessible to people, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And it's tricky because, like, I'll give you a funny example. I mean, you bring up Hay House, so that my publisher for my most recent book, as many people know, I mean, Hay House publishes book, all of Wayne Dyer's books are published by Hay House.
Yep.
You know, Louise Hay herself. I mean, a lot of it's very spiritual, metaphysical, if you will. And I, you know, most of the work that I do when I go out and speak again is in the corporate world, but I will from time to time get invited to speak at some of the Hay House events, which are fun. And I was at an event in Denver, this is back in the spring, And I was about to go up and speak, and this woman comes running up to me, and she says, "You're Mike Robbins, you're Mike Robbins." And I said, "Yeah." And she said, "You were here last month in Denver for an event for Charles Schwab, weren't you?" And I said, "I was." And she said, "My boyfriend was here, was at that event, and he loved it, and he got your book, and he told me all about it, and da, da, da." And she goes, "And I just want to thank you," she said, "because I've been trying to talk to him about this stuff for a long time."
Yeah.
"And I buy him these books, and he just rolls his eyes, and he would, and he, by the way," she said, "by the way, he would not be caught dead at this conference, the Hangouts conference," right? And I said to her, "You know, I so appreciate you saying that." I said, "Here's what's really funny. I said, I'm about to get up on that stage, and I'm going to say basically the same stuff I said at the Charles Schwab event. I said, I may touch on a few other things because the audience here is a little different, but basically it's going to be the same message." And she looked at me funny, like, "How is that possible?" And I said, and the truth of it is the context just changed a little bit. I said, "I probably said it in a way that he could actually hear it," mm-hmm. "and it didn't scare him."
I love
and
it.
And then she kind of laughed, and I just said, "So, you know, we could talk about this more, but," and part of what I then did talk about to the crowd there at the Hay House event was like, look, if we're trying to influence other people, if we go into a morally superior, self-righteous mode of doing it, they're not going to listen to us. And that's what we all got to be careful of. So even as we have this conversation about spirituality, which is like, okay, so is there a spiritual nature of teams? I believe so, absolutely. Is there a spiritual nature of the work I do? Yes, for sure. Mm-hmm. When I walk into the room, or whatever the room is, whether there's five people sitting around a table or 5,000 people at a big convention or anywhere in between, I got to use my own intuition,
right,
to know. And it's not a brain thing. It's something else. It's using your heart and tapping into some of that spiritual nature to know what does this group actually need right in this moment, and how can I best deliver that. Now, that's something that, and again, every single one of us who are listening, whether you've been doing this work for a very short amount of time or a long time, that to me is the sort of secret sauce of what makes us good at this. And that's why I think for all of the methodologies we have and all of the, you know, steps and processes we put people through and all the PowerPoint slides we put together and all of that, if you're going to be a really great facilitator of people, whatever you're facilitating about, you got to be able to dance in the moment with that. And that, to me, is so much about us trusting ourselves, tapping into that intuition. And if we think of it as a spiritual calling, which I do, absolutely bringing that forth.
Well, I have another question that relates back to the book, Nothing
Yep.
Changes Until You Do. And by the way, for those of you listening, you can find out lots more about the book and even download a chapter or two at mike-robbins.com. And you'll, if you go to the IATF website, you'll see all the links to Mike's work. And of course, you can go to Amazon, read the reviews, and get the book in print, hardcover, and in digital form. You could download it right now. And I
Yep.
highly encourage everyone to do that. So while we're sort of on this strain of talking about the work that we do,
Yep.
I have one other question. And this comes from yesterday. A colleague of mine, a good friend of mine in Texas, called me and said, "Oh, I can't make this call today. I really would love to see or hear what Mike has to say and maybe ask a question." And he said, "I watched the video. I posted a short video of you when I sent out this broadcast."
Mm-hmm.
And he said, and this is a gentleman who speaks, he'll put on 50,000 miles on his own car flying and then also fly all over the country.
Yep.
And he speaks a lot for a living. And he said, "I see Mike presenting in these videos and he seems so approachable, like and engaging and at ease on the stage." Can you tell us, give the rest of us some insight? I mean, all of us are probably on this call who are listening to the recording are probably standing in front of people
Yes.
and could use a tip.
Well, I appreciate that feedback and the question. Look, I love to speak. I mean, it's, I come from a long line of talkers. So talking is literally one of my favorite things. Like you and I talking right now, I love this. And, you know, my dad dad was in radio and television, there was just kind of something. So it's always sort of been something that I personally have a passion for. And when I started doing this 15 years ago, what I really wanted to do was be a speaker. Like, that, I want to speak. And whatever I need to do I need to write a book? Do I need to do, you know what I mean? Like, whatever can put me up in front of people, again, whether it's 5 or 500 or 5,000, I would. And the truth is, I didn't even know, Tom, what the hell I wanted to talk about. I mean, I had a few ideas, but I'm like, I've never been much of a painter or a singer or, you know, a sculptor. Like, my form of creativity is verbal expression. So that is that for me personally. The other thing I would say is that I've done it a lot. I mean, I probably deliver about 100 or so presentations of different types every year, and have done that for almost 15 years. Even back when I first started, and I was mostly speaking, you know, to the Rotary Club or wherever I was speaking, I was just out. And so over the years, having done it so much, I'm comfortable with it. It's not, look, I get nervous. I mean, but the other thing that I've done, and this is part of my personality and my approach, I don't use PowerPoint slides hardly ever. I tell a lot of stories. So I'm not super scripted when I go speak, but I tell a lot of the same stories because that's sort of my form of teaching. I find that people relate to and resonate with stories, and they're often personal stories. They're stories from my own life or about my wife or my girls or experiences I've had or relaying stories of other people. And the other thing that I do, again, it goes back to the inner work piece. It's like, I got to make sure that I'm as present as possible when I get up to speak. And I also trust my intuition. I mean, here's what will happen to me now, and just as we're talking about this, I'll get hired to speak at a big event like 10 months in advance. They're paying me a lot of money. I'm coming in, and I don't actually do a lot of preparation myself. I mean, I'll do the calls beforehand with the team. I'll talk to the people. I'll get all the information I need. I take my notes, blah, blah, blah. But I'll be sitting on the plane or sometimes in the hotel room before I'm going to speak. And at that point, I kind of go back and I look at some notes, and then I start to make maybe a little outline at best, but often just a list of stories and key points and what are some of their challenges and what are some things that I think would most benefit them. And even with all of that, it's in a folder. I don't even bring it up on stage, or if I do, I put it on the podium. And then when I'm speaking, I have kind of a general plan, but I'm using my intuition in the moment. Literally, sometimes, Tom, I'll start telling a story and I'll think to myself, why the heck am I telling this story? Like, this doesn't have anything to do with what I'm, you know what I mean? But without fail, that people will come up to me after, like, oh, I'm so glad you told that story about your dad. Wow. And then they'll tell me some story about their grandpa or their own dad or something, and I'll be like, oh, that must have been why I told that story, because they needed to hear it.
Wow.
So now, I know that sounds a little strange to people, and for some people, what I'm talking about would be incredibly stress-inducing to go about it that way, but for me, I've just found that that is the most fun and the most effective, and that's what allows me when I get up on stage, like, I'm just kind of dancing around in the conversation, and I'm not trying to give a speech.
Well,
if that makes sense.
It does. Well, so this actually fits in nicely to my next question, which goes back to the book, Nothing Changes Until You Do. And again, I want to encourage people, head over to Mike's website, Mike, M-I-K-E, hyphen Robbins, R-O-B-B-I-N-S.com. And you can find out more about the book. And so in your book, you talk about surrender. And out of all the topics, I've been thinking about this one because I had the pleasure in April, the pleasure and the agony of speaking at a TEDx event. And I know that you've had at least three, am I right? Three events. And so to hear you saying now, I must have written over and over again what I was going to talk about, and went on and on. So
yeah.
You and I are a little different in that respect, but you talk about surrender.
Yep.
And I'm wondering why you talk about surrender in this book, and then specifically, what is that? what does surrender mean to us for those of us who are out there in the world doing this type of work?
Well, look, surrender is one of those words and one of those ideas. It's kind of like, and I also talk about in Nothing Changes Until You Do, this idea of embracing powerlessness, which Eleanor talked to me about. And in both cases, my initial reaction to those things are like, those sound terrible. That sounds like a bad idea. Like, you know, part of my personality can be, I can be a bit type A and controlling and, you know, a lot of these things, even when I was talking before about how I go about speaking, it's evolved for me over time, and it's been more of a process of learning to surrender and to trust, which is not my forte, quite frankly. It's not what comes natural to me. So I've had to train myself. And why these things, I think, are so important, again, think of the work that we all do. We prepare, we do whatever we do. And again, each of us, our process might be different. The type of things we're doing might be different.
Mm-hmm.
But in the moment, can we surrender to the moment, to the experience that we're having, enough so that we can actually respond to what's happening? I learned this as an athlete. Again, all the preparation, and I'd go out on the mound, and then things would happen. And even as long as I played baseball from 7 until I was 23 when I got hurt, 25 when I retired. It's a lot of years of experience, especially being that young, having done something that long isn't all that common. But there would be stuff that would happen during the middle of a baseball game, even all the years I'd played, that I'd never experienced before. And I'd be like, how do I respond to that, right?
So wait, but how does help us understand what surrendering in the, I realize not everybody listening is a baseball fan necessarily,
yes.
but being in that moment and being in a competitive sports, many of us have played sports, but
sure.
What does surrendering look like versus not surrendering, especially in a highly competitive environment?
So it's surrender is also very akin to acceptance. It's like, look, Byron Katie says, when you argue with reality, you lose, but only 100% of the time. Right? So it's surrendering to what's actually happening in the moment, really being present and responsive to what's happening instead of trying to force the issue. Look, I'll put it in a context, though, of like speaking or presenting, because we've all had this experience. You go in and you're going to say, and a lot of times in a team environment, you're presenting in a small group situation, right? Which is actually a lot of times, as intimidating as it is to stand up on stage in front of 1,000 people, it's sometimes harder to stand up or even sit around a table in front of 10 or 12 or 4, right? Because you go in and you have a plan. I'm going to talk about these things. I'm going to teach these things. I'm going to facilitate this group through this process. And by the way, you start and it's not working. And they're not resonating. And they don't understand. Or someone's challenging you. Or something happens. Or you thought you had an hour and now you only have 20 minutes, or you thought you had 4 hours and now you only have 2, or whatever the heck it is, right? Or the leader of the group gets up in the middle to go take a call and you're like right in the middle of the most important part. What, you know, all those things happen and you go, okay, I got to surrender to this, meaning accept this is what's actually happening right now, mm-hmm. and let go of my script and respond in the moment. I always say to people, look, every time you go give a presentation, even your TED Talk, which, look, TED Talks are some of the hardest because of the time constraints, and it's challenging. Plus, they put you through a whole rigmarole about it if your TED event was anything like the 3 I've been to. But there's always 3 presentations that we give every time we give a presentation. There's the one we plan to give.
Right.
There's the one we actually give. And then there's the one we wish we would have given when we're driving away from the event. Right? And so the closer you can get to that surrender between the one I'm planning on, the one I'm actually giving, and the one that I'll probably wish I would have given later, surrender to, again, what's happening, what's going on, what's the response, what's actually happening in the moment, what does this group need, what do I need to do, how do I need to shift in the moment to be more effective, and part of that is letting go of our attachments and our expectations and our, you know, anally detailed plan that we had, and then really just being there in the moment, right? I think of it in the context of parenting. It's like there's amazing parenting books out there and some incredible experts who've written them. That's not anything really like what it's actually like to parent, at least in my experience. And my girls are only 9 and almost 7. So I'm still figuring it out, and I'm sure I'll continue to figure it out. And I can give great advice to other people about parenting, But sometimes with my own children, it's challenging, and part of it is because I got to be able to surrender in the moment and respond to my girls as they actually are, not as I think they should be or I think I should be.
So, you remind me of something I've told some other facilitators, is that I think ideally when we're working with teams, it's more like performance art, where mm-hmm. you're or improv,
yep.
where you're.
Yeah.
There's a dance going on. Well, I know we're getting close to the time where you have to leave. And Lorraine in New Zealand has a question. And she
yep.
writes, when one works with people in such a personal way, as you do,
yes,
you are vulnerable, you surrender. And much of your book, I think anybody who's reading this book will say, wow, this guy is on the leading edge of this. And she says, it can be challenging at times to know where the line is between coaching, in quotations, and therapy, in quotation
mm-hmm.
marks. How do you make sure you don't cross the line?
Well, I think it's a great question, Lorraine. And look, it's tricky, for sure. I mean, we start going down this path, and, you know, there's all kinds of stuff down there for people, if you will. Look, when I first got trained as a coach, 15 years ago when I was first starting, I took my training through an organization called CTI, the Coaches Training Institute.
Yes.
And one of the things they said there, which I really appreciated, just in a one-on-one basis, was like, look, coaching is very much about dealing with people in the moment, where are they and where are they headed, like moving forward. Therapy is a lot of looking at the past mm-hmm. issues, past traumas, challenges, you know, things.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a therapist. You know, my wife has her master's in psychology and was going to be a therapist, but then doing all the hours and training and listening to people's issues and problems, she decided, you know what, I think I'd rather be a coach. So she's a coach and does some hypnotherapy. But I think, so I will let people know, and when I used to coach people one-on-one more, I don't do much of that anymore. If it felt to me like they really needed a therapist, I would recommend that. Hey, it sounds like you could do some really great work in therapy. I know some great therapists. I'll give you some recommendations or go find somebody. But I think in a team environment, and again, I walk into these businesses and I'm in these corporations, and again, I'm sitting around a table with people at Google or talking to a group of people at Charles Schwab or wherever it may be. It's like they didn't hire a therapist. However, I literally did a session for a group last week, and when I got done, it was about 30, 40 people in the room, and I had some time with them. We did a few exercises and things. It was kind of, you know, a hybrid. It wasn't quite a team session. It wasn't quite a big speech, but it was more like a workshop. The woman got up after and said, wow, that was like therapy, right? And she was saying it in a really positive way. Everybody laughed, and, you know. But so, again, I think it's like giving people permission and the opportunity to look within themselves, to talk about things a little more personally, to engage with each other and talk a little bit about their relationships and the dynamics that exist. I think we all have some skill to be able to do that. And is it tricky? Yeah. And sometimes do we get into some murky waters? Sure. But I don't feel like I ever step over the line and try to pretend to be some kind of health professional or therapist that I'm not. All I'm trying to do is, like, look, a lot of this stuff is going on below the surface. People aren't talking about what's really happening. I feel like my job and the work that I do is to give them permission and make it safe for them to talk about some of that scary stuff. And if I do that, my job's done. And I just kind of help facilitate a little bit of that conversation and how they can connect more deeply. Because mm-hmm. a lot of the people and teams I'm working with, they're super smart and talented. They don't need me to come in and tell them how to do their work. They already know how to do that. They just need a little bit of safety and some space to actually go a little deeper into how they're feeling. And that, again, comes back to why I have to do my own inner work, because my job, I believe this, a good facilitator is really good at holding space.
Yes.
Right? And if you can hold space, and like what will happen, as an example, sometimes in that If You Really Knew Me exercise, as an example, Tom, people will cry, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not trying to make anyone cry. They don't have to cry. It's not bad if they do or don't. But sometimes some emotion will come out. Sometimes with some groups, a lot of emotion will come out. A lot of that in those moments, it's how do I respond to the tears? And what I'll often do, people will start apologizing, or they'll get all weird, or they'll want to get up and walk out of the room. And what I try to do as best I can, I'll just say, hey, you know what, hey, let's make sure they're okay. And then I'll often say, like, hey, listen, you don't ever have to apologize to me for your emotions.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And I'll say, does anybody else need an apology? No. And then it's like, okay. And then you realize, oh, wow. What if that wasn't the most taboo thing in the world? Right. I wrote a chapter, Nothing Changes Until You Do, about it. Like, it's give yourself permission to cry. Like, it's okay. It doesn't make you weak or overly emotional or weird. It makes you human. And teams that can sit around and cry together, that's a pretty strong team.
Well, we've got one more question, and this one's coming from Whitney.
Yeah.
And then we're going to close out here. And again, for the recording and for the live session here, please go to Mike's website. It's Mike-Robbins. It's Mike-Robbins.com. MIKE-ROBBINS.com. So Whitney writes this. She says, I work for an organization that doesn't understand leadership or teamwork. It's frustrating to know that this organization could be so much better, but no one at the top is willing to make any changes.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, what kinds of practical changes could I make that might impact a group of people who have no emotional intelligence or desire to do things in a different way?
Yeah, and that's, Whitney, that's one of the most difficult situations to face, quite frankly. You know, and sometimes we got to ask ourselves the hard question, like, am I in the right place? Might I be better served somewhere else? And sometimes we have the freedom and flexibility to make that choice. Sometimes that choice is made for us. And other times, you know what? I'm not willing to do that. I got to stay here. So how do I make the best of it? Look, I mean, the first thing, again, I said it before, it's the Gandhian principle. It's like, be the change. You want people to be more emotionally intelligent, more emotionally aware, more empathetic, compassionate, fill in the blank, whatever it is. Model it as best you can. Then there's also the part of how do you make some practical changes? Where can you find some places? Look, even if people aren't open to some of these ideas we're talking about, or they wouldn't talk about emotional intelligence or things like that, every single human being I've ever met in the work that I've done inside of organizations, they want to be successful. They want other people to be successful. They want to work in an environment that's conducive to success and also that's positive. I mean, those things are universal. I've never met anyone who says, I don't want to be successful. I want everyone to fail around me. I want to work in a really negative, critical, hostile environment. No, nobody wants that. Now, we all have different values and philosophies and different things we think are important. And, you know, even the person who's the most biggest jerk you've ever worked with, I don't think he or she wakes up in the morning and says, I'm going to go make everyone's life miserable today. They've just got whatever they got going on. So it's how do you find the common ground or the place where what's important to them? What are their values? What do they see? And maybe it's, again, do you focus and frame the conversation in success? I have found both when I was working and then in the last 15 years as a speaker and consultant and trainer and coach and facilitator that if you can couch it sometimes in this is going to make us better, this is going to have us be more – because it will. It does. It's not just – you're not blowing smoke. People are more open and interested. Mm-hmm. Looking at examples, again, I'm a former athlete, so I'll use examples from sports sometimes for someone and say, hey, did you notice Team X won the championship? You know, one of their keys to success was their incredible chemistry and how well – you hear those guys? Because now athletes talk about it. We love each other. We have each other's backs. Like they didn't talk about that 20, 30, 50 years ago. Now they do. So, again, I don't know what it is, but finding those different angles or places where you can say, hey, you know what, if we start doing X, Y, or Z, I think it's going to make us even better. You can get people's attention who may not be, you know, the most open-minded or touchy-feely, if you will.
Well, I just want to mention here that Sandra King writes that, thanks, Mike. I've also been trained by CTI. Your conversation this afternoon so resonated with me as it's always about the inner work. Looking forward to reading your books. So,
cool.
Yeah, it's I know we need to end here. You've got another responsibility to get to at the top of the hour. And so I just want to thank you so much for the work that you're doing and the message that you're sharing with everyone. And I'm wondering if, do you have any ideas on what's next for you or what's coming up, big projects?
You know, well, first of all, you're welcome. And I appreciate being on here and connecting with you and your community again. And I think, you know, in terms of next projects, it's interesting. This whole concept of bring your whole self to work, which kind of brings together a lot of the work I've done on authenticity and self-compassion, all that is feeling like that's maybe the next book and maybe the next focus of where I'm headed. But, you know, I'm grateful in the fact that, You know, I always have plans and intentions and things that I focus on. And one of my personal edges these days is also just trusting and allowing things to unfold and sort of, you know, let the next steps kind of show up as opposed to me always having to go figure it out and make it happen. So,
wait, are you saying that you're actually surrendering?
I'm working on it. It's easier for me to talk about surrender than to actually surrender, but yes, that's part of the process.
Well, that's good. Well, I can resonate with that, being someone who likes to always think that there's a three-step process to everything or something. Is that maybe the first step could be surrendering. I think I'm going to have to go back and read that chapter.
Yes, you know what Eleanor was talking to me about this morning, and I wrote it down because she was talking about unconditional receiving. And I was like, what is that? And she said, it means receiving just because. I was like, you mean I don't have to earn it? I don't have to prove it? I don't have to deserve it? And she was like, not unless you think you do. So that was my little nugget from my session this morning with Eleanor. So I'm sort of sitting with that one personally. But I also think, again, that's relevant to my work and lots of our works out there in the world. So,
all right. I think I hear another book in the making. All right. Well, Mike, thanks again for being joining our community. And as always, it's a pleasure to talk with you.
Absolutely, Tom. Thanks for having me, and I just appreciate what you do and what everybody who's listening to us does, because the work we're all doing is really important.
I agree. Well, thanks again, everybody, for being here. Head on over to visit Mike's website. It's Mike dash or hyphen robbins.com. You'll also find the link at the IATF website. Please share. I'm going to be posting the recording to this at the IATF website. Please share it with your friends, people that you think might benefit from this. And certainly consider buying a book for a friend and handing it to them. It's easy to read. It's 40 different chapters. You don't have to read it and from 1 to 40. You can jump around. It's written in a really easy way to digest. So, all right, everybody. Thanks again. Look forward to talking with you soon. Bye-bye.